right. Hi, everyone. Can everyone hear me okay in the back? All right. Well, the title of my presentation is Description of Primary Caregivers to Adults Over the Age of 70, and I just wanted to acknowledge my co-authors, Ron Natale and John Cruz. I have no relationships to disclose. A quick outline of my presentation. I'll go into a little bit of background on my topic. I'll describe the longitudinal study on aging, which is the data source that I used for this presentation. We'll describe the care recipients that responded to the survey. Then we'll go into a description of the caregivers and how that changes over time, and then I'll go into my conclusions. So for background, it's pretty widely known that the population of older adults in the United States is growing. It's estimated that the population of adults over age 65 is going to double between the year 2000 and 2030, and it's projected to be about 40 million by 2010. And this upward shift in age distribution is going to lead to an increase in the size of the population of older adults experiencing chronic disability. And with this increase in chronic disability, we expect an increased awareness of reliance on informal and formal caregiving. These data are from a report done by AARP in 2005 called Staying the Course, Trends in Family Caregiving. Approximately 55% of older adults with chronic disability received help from another person. Spouses and children are the most common source of informal caregiving, and of those receiving any caregiving, a third of older adults who receive care used formal caregiving mechanisms. The objectives of my study are to describe primary caregivers to older adults, both the characteristics of the caregivers and what tasks they assist with, and then evaluate how this changes over time. In terms of methods, our data source is the longitudinal study on aging, which was conducted from 1994 to 2000. It's a survey that was based off the National Health Interview Survey. It was a nationally representative sample of people living in the community, at least at baseline. And it included all surveyed adults from the NHIS who were age 70 and older in the 1994 survey, giving us a data set of about 9,500 respondents. These data were collected at three different time points. Wave 1, or baseline, was collected from 1994 to 1996. Wave 2 was from 96 to 98, and Wave 3 was from 98 to 2000. And though the data collection period happened over 3 years, each respondent was the data was supposed to be collected at every 2 years, so each respondent, the different waves are at 2-year intervals. For each survey, for all three waves, there were various questions on caregiving activities. These questions included number of caregivers, who they are, describing the caregivers, what activities they helped with, and the amount of time dedicated to caregiving. And there was a question for each wave, identifying the primary caregiver or the caregiver that provided the most help to the care recipient. Statistically, our methods in this presentation are primarily means and proportions. The latter portion of my presentation, I'll be talking about some logistic regressions. And just generally, for each of these regressions, we controlled for gender of the care recipient, race, comparing white versus non-white respondents, the baseline age of the care recipient, and the care recipient's self-reported health. Now, looking at our care recipients at baseline, for the entire sample, the mean age was about 77 years. It was about 60% female and about 90% white. Now, comparing that to the subset of people that had a caregiver at baseline, which was about a third of the population, the mean age was slightly higher at 79 and a half years. It was slightly more female at 70%. Racially, it was about the same, about 88% white. And of those that had at least one caregiver at baseline, 44% of them reported having two or more caregivers. Looking at who provided care, we saw a pretty significant difference between male care recipients and female care recipients. So on this bar graph, we separated out the gender of care recipient. For our male care recipients, they relied primarily on their spouses at over 50%, with sons and daughters and other sources of care filling in those gaps. Our female care recipients had a much wider spectrum. About 20% of them received their primary care from their spouse, 26% from a daughter, and then about 22% from a paid employee, with sons and other relatives, and then other friends or family, friends and neighbors, providing for care in those gaps. A couple of other things about our primary caregivers at baseline. Excluding spouses, approximately 30% of caregivers for both men and women lived in the same household. And women care recipients were more likely to have a female caregiver than male care recipients at about 78% compared to 70% for the male care recipients. Looking at the tasks that the caregivers provided care for at baseline, I divide this up into ADLs and IADLs. For activities of daily living, or ADLs, eating was the task that the primary caregiver helped with least at about 4%, and that increased to about 20% for bathing and showering. And we'll go a little bit more into depth with the ADLs and IADLs further in the presentation. For our IADLs, using the telephone was the task that was helped with least by the primary caregivers at about 7%, and it goes up to about 60% for both shopping for groceries and heavy housework at baseline. Okay, now we'll go into looking at how these things change over time. And from here to the rest of my presentation, our denominator is all of our respondents from the survey that survived through all three waves. That includes people that didn't report a caregiver at any time point. And our N on that is about 6,600 respondents. So first, looking at our male care recipients, we see that magenta group on the bottom is our spouses. And the spouses provide the most amount, or the most likely to be the primary caregivers throughout time, and that increases as we go into waves two and three. We also see a pretty big jump in the number of male survey respondents that have a caregiver. It goes from about 15% at wave one to over 50% by wave three, so it's a pretty big jump in only a four-year interval. Now, comparing that to our female care recipients, we see the wider spectrum for the females, where their primary caregivers tended to be a lot of different people rather than their spouses, and these groups just expanded over time. There was no one group that expanded significantly more than the others, but you can see a pretty big difference between those two groups and who is providing care for these older adults. Now, looking at the tasks that they provided help with over time, these are two summary variables. The yellow line on the bottom is our summary variable for ADLs. The ADLs included in the summary variable are bathing and showering, dressing, eating, getting in and out of a better chair, walking, and using the toilet. And these percentages represent if they received help in any of these ADLs. So from wave one, it's at about 7%, and that increases to about 12% by wave three, so a 4% or 5% increase in just 4 years. For our IADLs, the tasks included in this summary variable are preparing meals, shopping for groceries, managing money, using the phone, heavy housework, light housework, and managing medications. And we see a bigger jump in this four-year time period. It starts at 22% and goes up to 36% in those 4 years. So a pretty big jump in people receiving help for IADLs. Now, for the rest of the presentation, we wanted to look at some of the specific ADLs and IADLs to see whether there were different patterns that we saw or whether ADLs and IADLs were similar for who was providing care. So our first selected ADL is bathing and showering. And what we saw is that for all waves, the paid caregivers were more likely to provide care for bathing and showering than any of the family caregivers. You're looking at the screen, the different colors kind of represent the group that we found the most interesting pattern for. So the paid caregivers were most important in terms of bathing and showering. In terms of changes over time, there was a statistically significant increase for daughters from wave two to wave three. And then we saw a significant decrease for spouses from wave one to wave two. So the spouses were providing high levels of care at wave one, and that decreases over time, where for the daughters it tended to increase. We saw kind of a similar pattern over time for dressing. Spouses provided more care in wave one and then decreased in wave two and wave three, where for daughters, it increases from wave two to wave three. And the increase is also seen for paid caregivers. Comparing the different types of caregivers, the sons and daughters were less likely to provide care for dressing than the paid caregiver across all three waves. Looking at walking, this is an ADL that has a slightly different pattern. The daughter was more likely to help than the paid caregiver during wave one, and spouses were more likely to help during wave one and wave three, primarily the husbands. Looking over time, the son was more likely to help from wave two to wave three, and spouses were less likely to help from wave one to wave two. So a similar pattern where the sons and daughters had an increase as time went on, where the spouses had a decrease. Looking at some of the IADLs, we'll start with preparing their own meals. In this, we see a pretty different pattern for the paid caregivers. They were less likely than any of the family caregivers to provide help with preparing own meals. Over time, the spouses were actually more likely to provide help with preparing own meals from wave one to wave two. So this is a slightly different pattern than what we saw with the ADLs. Looking at shopping for groceries, it's similar for the paid caregivers. They were less likely to help with this task than any of the paid caregivers. Over time, only the sun had a statistically significant increase from wave 1 to wave 3. The other groups provided similar levels of care across all three waves. Looking at heavy housework, this looks a little bit more like the ADLs in terms of for the paid caregivers, where they're more likely to provide care for all three waves than the family caregivers. Looking at this over time, the paid caregivers' daughters and spouses were less likely to provide care from wave 1 to wave 2. In terms of managing money, the paid caregiver is less likely to help than any of the family caregivers. Another similar pattern. In terms of managing medications, I don't think the slide is interesting by itself. The daughter and spouse is more likely to help in wave 1 and wave 2 than the paid caregiver, and there isn't much change over time. I was just really surprised by how low these numbers were. It ranged from about 5 to 20% across all waves and all types of caregivers. And this is something that I think, if we do this survey again now, I think these numbers would be much, much higher with increased awareness about drug interactions. So I just want to point out how low this seemed to be for the 90s. So our conclusions. The need for caregivers increases rapidly as older adults reach age 70 and beyond. And a lot of these people were receiving care way before age 70, but we saw this pretty substantial spike from in just 4 years as they reach age 70 and beyond. We also saw that the gender of the care recipient affects on whom they rely for care. Men tend to rely on their wives, where women tend to rely on their children and paid health. Looking at the task by time point, wives and husbands to some extent tended to be more likely to provide care in wave 1 with decreased amounts of care in wave 2 and wave 3. Daughters and paid caregivers provided help at high levels for all waves. Sons tended to increase help on tasks during later waves. And for many of the tasks, we saw decreased levels of help at wave 2, where it was high at wave 1, decreased for wave 2, and then it came back up in wave 3. Looking at the types of tasks, there was a variation between what kind of caregiver would help with each task. The paid caregivers provided high levels of help for most ADLs, as well as heavy housework. Husbands had higher levels of help for physical tasks, such as walking, shopping, and heavy housework. Wives provided high levels of help on preparing meals, and they were similar to other groups for most other ADLs and IADLs. Sons provided the biggest contributions in shopping, heavy housework, and managing money. And the daughters had high levels of help for all ADLs and IADLs, and we would classify them as the most versatile caregivers in this study. In terms of our public health implications, I mentioned the imminent increase in the size of population of older adults, and that's going to increase the need for caregiving due to disability among this population. Home-based care is really important for this group. Most older adults report having a preference for aging in place at home rather than going into assisted living or a nursing home. There have also been studies that it's cheaper for older adults to stay at home and work with informal caregivers than to have paid caregivers or going into an institution. And this study provides background evidence for those who design programs to support older adults and their caregivers. It can help determine the areas of greatest needs and which caregivers need the most support. Our limitations, it's self-reported data, and particularly it's the care recipient providing data about the caregiver. So we think there may be some discrepancies with what the care recipient thinks the caregiver is doing, whether they underreport or overreport depending on the task. Like I mentioned, this is old data. The last data point was collected in 2000, so these data are about a decade old. And in some situations, especially managing medications, we think that it's pretty likely that these numbers will be a little different if this survey was fielded again. We had some issues with the longitudinal data analysis, particularly in that it was difficult to identify whether a caregiver remained the same caregiver over time, particularly for paid caregivers and sons and daughters. If an older adult had multiple daughters, it was difficult to say whether it was a specific daughter providing care or whether it switched between the two waves. So rather than try to analyze the caregiver over time, we basically analyzed it as three cross-sectional looks at the same population, which isn't quite as strong as traditional longitudinal methods, but we thought it was the most appropriate for this situation. And a final limitation is that for this analysis, we focus on the primary caregiver. The survey takes data up to four different caregivers, so there's a lot more data that we want to look at, but for this particular analysis, we want to focus on the caregiver just to start with this picture and then hopefully expand it as we continue on with this research. So here's our contact information if you have any questions after the presentation, but that is all. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. We actually have some time for questions, and there's a mic in the middle of the room if you'd mind going up to that mic for the questions. Could you use the mic, please?
Interpreting that you're probably saying that there's a whole range of activities in which people are getting help, but they're not the traditional ADLs and IADLs that are being actually asked about explicitly, like in the SIP and the HRS. Because your number, when you went to the HRS, I guess when you combined it to ADLs and IADLs, your numbers went way down, right?
Well, I don't have any measure in the HRS of non-ADL, IADL disability. It's strictly limited to people who have one of those disabilities, because those are the people they ask about caregiving. I think that there is a big difference between if you ask people about specific tasks and you say, do you have difficulty with this? And only if you report having difficulty with one of these 10 tasks that we ask you, could you possibly be eligible to have a caregiver,
right?
Versus something that says, for example, the question in the behavioral risk factor surveillance survey is one question of, do you assist any time in the past month any friend or family member who has a disability, illness, or because they're of old age? So that's a much broader category, and you've got a larger interpretation of that than, you know, these 10 tasks. So I do think that there's that. I think there's also a big difference the reference period that you're looking at. So some of the surveys look at over the past year, have you provided any assistance? And you're going to come up with a very different number than have you done it in the past month.
I'm just wondering whether the IADLs and the ADLs are just not exhaustive in terms of the kinds of help people get. I bet that's true.
You know, that's the debate that the disability, you know, community has a lot of, whether they're a good measure of disability. I think that there are a lot of tasks that aren't included in the ADLs and IADLs. From a policy perspective, you have to wonder who, if you've got a limited number of resources, who are the people that you want to help the most? And are they the people that are doing ADL and IADL assistance, or are they the people doing the other ones? And I don't have an answer.
And with, okay, and how you're hogging the microphone. With the SIP, you use the adult functional limitation module. There's also the caregiving module, right? And have you tried looking across those?
So there is the caregiving module, and it's, you know, a future project one day to look at, you know, to see if I can in any way match up dyads within a household to look at that. However, it is restricted to people who are in the same household.
Right.
And the SIP, that part of the SIP asks limited questions about ADLs and IADLs. So it's more difficult with that section to what a caregiver is doing, and is it because someone has a limitation, or is it just because it's what they do?
As a daughter caregiver, it struck me that it would be interesting to marry Erin's concept to Melissa's and look at the role of these various folks in case management for the older adult, because I think a lot of the time that might be spent, some of it might be in direct care, but a lot of it may be actually in case management and getting services and Medicare and so forth.
That is something that's unfortunately some, I'm not sure if there's an IADL question out there about any sort of case management, but it wasn't something that was asked across the two, so I could, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think I recall having any in the LFA either.
There are other questions?
Interesting information. I wonder if any of you looked at the effect size of having help versus not having help, or having a caregiver or not having a caregiver. That's question one. Question two is, did anybody look at the effect of PAS or caregiving beyond the task difficulty, that is looking at changes in participation in the community or within family? And three, anybody look at training? And what, if any, training do the informal or formal care providers have?
In terms of training and, other, like, the participation measures, I think I'm limited by the questions in the LOSA. I don't recall any participation or training questions in there. In terms of effect size, I have not looked at that yet. Is something for the future?
So training is a question that is generally asked more in the surveys that go and look at the general population and ask for caregivers. So I know that the National Alliance for Caregiving Survey has some questions about training, as does the National Survey of Family and Households. I did not look at those data, but I know that that data is available out there. And anecdotally, from my work with caregivers in the community, it's pretty low in terms of, in my impression, that there's very little training out there for caregivers. In terms of assistance outside of the task specific, I was limited in my analysis because they do identify people by ADLs, non-ADLs. That was the only information I had. But like I said, those other surveys do collect a lot of that information, much more detailed information about what are you doing to help. And effect size of people getting help versus not getting help and this has a lot to do with the way that you phrased the question. In the health and retirement survey, I generally found about 30 and 40% of people who had an ADL or IADL disability had a caregiver. Whereas in the survey of income and program participation, it was closer to around 50% of people had a caregiver. So.
One of the things we actually did talk about, including training, and we eventually dropped it just because of space. But in terms of participation, I mean, we can look at it, but I don't think we cannot get anything but changes in participation just because it's a cross-sectional survey, and so we're limited to it. But you know, when I get back, I can look at some more of the bureaucracy's questions on participation. And the other issue that I just want to talk about, because we have a follow-up survey on caregiving, and so we had asked our respondents, you know, if we can interview, you know, get a caregiver, an informal caregiver, and if we can interview them. So what we actually found, which was interesting, was that individuals with disabilities who identified as having an informal caregiver, and then we called the informal caregiver, you know, spouse, daughter, relative, they did not, particularly family members, did not identify themselves as being a caregiver. So, I mean, for example, there was a woman, a gentleman with, you know, pretty significant functional limitations, you know, identified his wife, and we called up the wife. She was like, I'm not a caregiver, I'm a wife, I'm a spouse, I'm not a caregiver. So I think some of these issues don't get translated into, you know, the larger longitudinal studies, and I think there's a lot of, you know, it's all about how we ask the questions, and a lot of piloting needs to be done to see really, you know, in terms of what populations we get.
Good for you, that last part. Glenn White and I did a study of paralyzed veterans, the wives of paralyzed veterans. They don't want to be called caregivers. Mm-hmm. So be aware of that when you ask that question, how do we get stoned? The reason I brought up, one of the reasons I brought up the training thing is that in the state of Missouri we have a proposition that basically is going to bring unions into the paid personal assistance arena. And since 40% of the people who provide that are family members, you're going to have a union family member getting 2 weeks off. It's going to happen to you. So it might be something. Are there any surveys that ask about whether the person is in the union or probably not, but some states are doing this, you know.
Massachusetts.
Yeah, California has a strange way of doing it as usual, but more or less unions. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think the survey questions have caught up with the changes in policy that have, I mean, over the past 5 years even, we've seen this huge increase in a lot of these community and home-based labor programs that have allowed family members to get paid, especially with the success of the cash and counseling programs. So the surveys have not caught up yet to do that, and part of the issue with a lot of these surveys is that if you're paid, you're not considered an informal caregiver anymore. But a lot of these people who are paid are providing some hours paid and a lot of hours not paid. And so it's becoming a very difficult issue that I don't think the surveys have caught up with in terms of how do we get information about these people. So I agree, it's a great thing.
So for all three of you, what kind of policy change would you suggest from what you've learned?
I wouldn't suggest policy change. My focus is on surveys. So I would, you know, love to get my hands on one of those surveys and say, here, let me have half an hour to ask all the questions I want, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Avoidance.
Well, the purpose of our survey was really to help direct policy indirectly, and I think the primary thing that is going to come up, and it's already on the table, particularly with the Community First and all these papers, is really to increase home and community-based services for this population of people with disabilities who sort of fall between the cracks. You know, they're aged out, not aged in. They don't come up with the traditional DMR, DMH. You know, so and there is a significant need for services for these populations. So it's really the next step is to figure out how this can be arranged. Now, of course, having said this, in the last 2 years since we've done this, you know, we've been doing this survey, the budget crisis in Massachusetts is, you know, it's a big deal now. So, you know, again, we're back in the, the issues of just providing basic services now. So, you know, honestly, I don't think this is going to go anywhere. You know, no one is going to listen to increasing services. Now it's all about cutting. So, but you know, things were good. I think they're still going to try. The disability advocacy groups are very strong in Massachusetts, and they're still going to try to have services for these people who fall between the cracks. So, I'm not sure that's answered your question.
Well, back in the day, 4 million. How do you draw that line? It's what the politicians will ask you. Given our national bankruptcy, we probably won't have to worry about that for a while. But do you think as a strategy that you should carve out groups and try to get personal assistance for some groups using the economic analysis, or give it to a broader range of everybody in need?
Well, the initial, you know, why this presentation, I mean, why this survey even came about was actually just because of that. Because the advocacy groups have gone to the legislators, they came back with exactly the same response, and in terms of that the woodworking effect, you know, more people are going to come out, they're going to need it, so that's why the survey was you know, we got money from the legislator, we were involved in this, you know, the results are out. Now, the disability advocacy group is just taking this very clearly, saying, okay, you know, 40% just need information. You know, that this is not huge dollars here. You know, so they're taking it, and so even when I make my presentation saying that this is an underestimate, they don't want to hear it. So they're sort of, you know, taking it as, you know, these are pretty high functioning group, and this is the group that's actually going to need it. I can't answer that, you know, which group should get it and which group shouldn't. Services should be offered to everybody, but of course, you know, if there are groups that are already getting services through the existing, you know, the traditional state agency categories, then, you know, given limited or no resources, we should concentrate on those who are not getting the services.
That's why I asked the effect size question at the beginning.
Right.
I think some of the conversation at this point has spoken, first of all, to some of the social aspects of caregiving. And I think when you look at gender differences in caregiving, some of what you're seeing is that the, you know, the social roles that people have. So some do the things that can be done when you don't have to be in the home at any certain time. And, you know, years ago when I did some work on caregiving and gender effects, there were women who said, older women said, my husband's never seen me totally naked, and he's not going to start now. But I think looking at social roles is something that, you know, these relationships don't exist in a vacuum. I think that's something that actually can be modeled. But I had a question for the last speaker where you said you thought the medication management piece would increase in coming years. I guess I'm wondering exactly why you think, because you talked about increased awareness of medication interactions. But what I'm finding is that people mean a whole lot of different things by medication management. And it's filling the pill box, or it's drawing up the injection, or, you know, actually giving the medication. And actually, I find very few people so far for whom it's really managing what medications people are getting in terms of thinking about interactions. That's kind of left to the physician and the pharmacist. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little more.
It was something that, as we were discussing the presentation, something we had started talking about. And I think just that there just more awareness that maybe the sons and daughters are realizing that drug interactions are a common reason for people to go in the hospital or have negative outcomes. I haven't really seen much work done on it, or it was just more of a hypothesis that I was throwing out, that it's something that I would have guessed that it would go up over time, and it was just something I was kind of throwing out to the group, that I don't really have much evidence base to support that, but it was just a thought that we had had in discussing that one particular outcome.
Thank you.
Also for Melissa, I was wondering whether you had stratified your results by living arrangement. As Monica mentioned, living alone is a big effect. UCSF have done analyses in which living alone is like the biggest thing. And, you know, your gender differences may largely be the fact that the women are widowed. So I wonder, you know, I'm sure there's still some gender difference, but I wonder whether it would be smaller and maybe not quite so damning of the of the men in the household.
Yeah, no, that's definitely part of it. We haven't looked quite as much at the living situation yet. The numbers are similar for each wave, but we think it's also some of the women moving into the homes of their sons and daughters. It's something that we definitely have planned for future analysis, but we didn't really address very much in this particular presentation. But yeah, definitely something that we have.
Are there other questions?
I just wanted to comment on what Monica's been saying about you're emphasizing unmet need and people don't want to hear it. I mean, my experience is that people always say that the numbers they want are the accurate numbers, they just want the truth. But what they really want is if it's a kind of civil rights issue, you know, something that you want to show that there's a huge population of people with disabilities, they want big numbers and they're upset with you if the numbers are smaller than they expect. But if it's the cost of a program,
right,
they want it to be a small number with a small number of participants and not a large reward effect. So
So, you know, people are upset with me because I don't produce national disability estimates that are, you know, 64 million or whatever they want. But they're delighted with us because we have a really low cost estimate for the Community Choice Act, used to be Mikasa, you know. So, this is kind of interesting. So, you know, and of course, you don't want to be spinning at your estate agents.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I tell, is just, you know, it's up to you. I mean, I basically say it's up to you to spin the data. This is it. You know, I mean, I pretty much clearly have said it, too. And I think it depends on the goal of what this, and that's why I'm right in the beginning, and I said, and actually, it's based on what you said yesterday at the disabilities big thing, is that, you know, you really want presentations more about the interaction between advocacy and research, and I was like, you know, this is advocacy research and the public, I mean, and state, you know, health departments here, you know, leading to, hopefully, public policy. And it's intricate. It's you know, it's we're constantly, you know, wanting to make sure, you know, the goals are the same between the advocates and us. You know, we want the same thing. It's like, how do we formulate this relationship so that we don't get into trouble either, you know? So it's a very fine line. So, and I know it's going to take right now, so I should shut up.
Maybe I'll summarize and hook everybody's comments together, but, you know, the comment about being the future and kind of aiming some of these questions, and the comment about these things being used for different policy things and throwing money at stuff, and with the trends seeming to be both on the federal level and in long-term care insurance to keep people in the home, begin looking at paying family members for providing care. It would be interesting to look as we come up with a new set of questions of how we're going to capture that, this change in payment status and getting those people to say, well, I'm paid this number of hours and I provide this additional care informally, and you know how some of these surveys are going to start capturing some of that change so that if they want to fund this more, we have numbers that will indicate how many spouses are providing unpaid aid and could use some help with some payment. You know, some of those other issues that will change.
Yeah, I will just add that one of the major flaws is that, I mean, a lot of these state programs actually don't allow you to pay your spouse. The spouse is not allowed to be one of the caregivers. And it's interesting, in the health and retirement survey, spouses are not asked if they're paid. They ask everyone else, but spouses are not asked. So, you know, that's a whole other issue of what to do with these spouses.
Because you realize now you could do this forever. You can see that we're setting you up to do that.
I'm just going to graduate first. But I'll do that.
We still have about 10 more minutes if anyone has any other questions.
I got a quick one.
Relationship is so important, you know, and that's really the creation of public policy.
I mean, for example, the Disability Policy Consortium, when they wanted to have this survey, they didn't need us. I mean, they could have just gone to, you know, this is Massachusetts, there's like a university in every street corner. I mean, they could have easily gone and, you know, but they, I mean, they knew our expertise, and they, you know, and you know, we have a very, very good relationship, solid relationship with them. I mean, they're also ready to sue us at the drop of a hat. I mean, again, no, I mean, we're constantly in these different dichotomies here. But, and that's what works. I mean, that's what, you know, needs to get the job done, and so be it. So, you know, the goal is the same, it's just how our interactions are. The informal interactions count for a lot. So, I mean, that's something else that, you know.
Keep it going.
Yep, you have to. Thank you.
Oh. Okay, well, if there are no other questions, the next program event, there are several excellent posters that are going to be down in halls ABC, so join us for that starting at 12:30, and then the next in this room will be at 2:30 at Disability and International Health Program. Thank you very much.